as we know it in Judaism, we know life is of infinite value. And basically, life takes precedence just about everything. As we mentioned, save the big three, that there are three cardinal sins that the Torah says better to die al kiddush Hashem, better to die and sanctify your life than to violate those sins, i.e. idol worship and murder and adultery. And just to quickly explain the philosophy behind that is because they're basically, why is it? It makes sense the other way. That better to violate, if someone's dying or someone's sick and they have to go to the hospital, it makes sense, better to violate one Shabbos and therefore you have the rest of your life to do mitzvahs and good deeds. Does it make any sense that better to die and then that's it, and you could never do any more mitzvahs? So why is it that for these three things, the Torah says better to die for? Okay, murder I understand, but idol worship or adultery, one could argue that maybe it's better to violate that one time and then have a whole life. So in Judaism, there are two basic categories. There's two categories everyone knows about, and there's a third category that's not so popular. The two basic categories, as symbolized by the two tablets, are the commandments between man and God and commandments between man and man. And we know the first five tablets, the commitments between you and your Creator, to believe in God, not to worship idols, etc. And the second five are not to murder, not to steal, not to commit adultery, etc., not to do different things. And those are commandments, but other machavero, between man and man. So, and one might ask, that seems to be number five, seems to be out of place. Honoring your parents should be on the wrong side of the tablets. It should be on the second side, because your parents are people too. So the Talmud tells us there are three creators, mommy, daddy, and God, not necessarily in that order. We all have three creators. So therefore, if commandments between you and your Creator are on the first side. And that's why it's a good transition from one tablet to the other, because parents actually play a dual role, a role of the people as well as your Creator. So therefore, it's a nice transition. So therefore, we know there are two basic categories, ben adam l'makom, as it's known, commandments between man and God, and commandments between man and man. So the question is, so if you had to draw the end of a line to a certain category, I said commandments between man and God, if you go in the opposite direction, where do you draw the line? What's the opposite, the end result of a commandment between man and God? If you know the different things, or different things along the way, but worshiping idols, rejecting God, that's a total rejection. So it's the end of the line of the category of commandments between man and God. To that, the Torah says, better to die a life of purity than have the sin of idol worship on your soul. And similarly, we understand what is murder. Murder, we have commandments to be nice to one's friends and you're not allowed to hit them, curse them, etc. But if you have to go to the end of the line of the category, that's murdering someone is the end of the line of the category of interpersonal relations. And that's why better die a life of purity than have the stain of murder on your soul. However, where does adultery, where does illicit relations fit in? In other words, which category is that? There's a third category, and that's called ben adam li'atzmo, that a person's own potential, that in secular society is not really focused on enough. That basically, like, if you see, if someone's committing adultery, or, you know, let's have a wife swapping, and so what's the reaction is, well, you're going to hurt the other partner, implying that if the other partner agreed to it, there's nothing wrong with it. But in Judaism, there's a higher source. Even if everyone agrees to it, there's something inherently wrong with it. Basically, you're killing yourself. That adultery, illicit sins, that's the end of the line in the category of Adam Liatzwa. Interesting, it's interesting, very interesting, Rav Sajagon on the Ten Commandments. And he gives a list. Anytime you're dealing with serious offenses, you know, you always run into the problem of thinking it's not so bad. But he gives a list from the less severe to the most severe in terms of sexual crimes. So he says when it says not to commit adultery in the Ten Commandments, it's not just limited to adultery, but he has a whole list. He says from least severe to most severe, he says, number one is two single people living together, a single man, a single woman living together. Why is it the least severe? Because all that is lacking is a maisa kedushin, an act of marriage. There's nothing stopping them from living together. Just get your document, go get married, and that's fine. Then he says the next level, he says, is a husband living with his wife when she's in nida, during the menstrual cycle. Again, that if you wait a couple more days and wait another week, she'll become permitted to you. So it's something which is easily reconcilable. Then he goes on to another case where he gets on to a married woman. Obviously, a married woman you can't live with, but he says, but either through if there's mises habal, the death of the husband, or a divorce. So there are ways a person could marry this woman. And then he gets to the end of the line. First of all, he says the two last ones, he says homosexuality, he says bestiality. And he puts homosexuality second to last, and he puts bestiality last. So the question is, based on his principle, they should be the same, because his principle is the harder it is to permit the act, or the more effort it takes to get the two people together, the worse it is. So homosexuality is never going to be permitted, and bestiality will never be permitted. You know, someone to say, you know, I guess kind of tongue-in-cheek, that perhaps, you know, we have the sex change operation. So in theory, man, even though it's not so simple in halakha that we recognize anyway that the sex change. But either way, he says it's homosexuality, then bestiality. But it's interesting to note that even though it's probably not the conclusion anymore, but originally when the AIDS virus came out, so the original assumption people thought, how did it come out first, was that some pilot out went to Africa and they lived with a monkey and they spread the whole virus. You know, but it's true or not, you know, that later on people, you know, had different theories. But the point being is it's not so much as, assuming that was true, it's not so much as a punishment, but it's a natural consequence. And if you pervert the way things are supposed to go, so the natural consequence is, you know, diseases come in sickness. So it's interesting that the one and the worst, the bottom line scenario of illicit relations, bestiality, might have been the cause for AIDS and these different diseases. But either way, the three categories are commandments between man and God. So the end of the line is idol worship. Command interpersonal relations, the end of the line is murder. And Gilui Arayos, illicit relations, that's the end of the line of Adam Liatzmo. You're causing better to die a life and sanctify your name than to die with the sin on your soul. So we know, but those three are the exceptions to the rule. The rule is, in human life, takes precedence over everything else. And that's why, even we know how precious Shabbos is to us, Yom Kippur, all the holidays, but when there's a life-threatening situation, even a doubtful life-threatening, you're not sure. You're not a doctor. Well, someone's lying on the street. Well, I'm not sure. Let's just leave them. No, is that the way it works? You're not sure. It's the same commandment. You have to go and make sure. You take them to the hospital. You call a doctor. Whatever has to be done. Everything, all the laws are suspended, and you have to make sure you take care of whoever needs the help. So that's the rule. So we have many halachas like this, showing the importance of human life and how it takes precedence over all the different things. And in fact, we even have a principle in the Gemara, Chamira Sakanta Meisura, which means we're more strict when it comes to a danger to someone's self than we are to something which is prohibited. So an example the Gemara gives is, let's say we know you can't have milk and meat together. However, let's say a drop of milk falls into the chicken soup. So you can't intentionally pour milk in because you like the way it tastes. But if by accident the milk fell into the soup, so there's a halakha called bitul b'shishim, that if the soup is the chicken soup, if it's French onion soup, it won't be a problem. But if it's meat soup, it's chicken soup. So if it's 60 times...
There's a problem.
Right, if it's 60... Not the French, right? Not the French onion soup. I'm talking about with the cheese on top, right? In the kosher restaurant.
Right.
To have, so it's, if it's 60 times the volume, so the halacha is, you go ahead and it's permitted to, you drink the soup, everything's fine. In fact, in Hasidish Svarim, they say it's even premium soup. You should share it with everyone because the concept in Hasidish is something that was once bad and turns good, that's even a higher level. A Baal Tshuva, someone who stumbled, but the bottom line, it's okay. But if a drop of poison, even if you're not sure, if a drop of poison might have fell into your soup, so that's it. There's no batul b'shishim, that's it, you got to throw out the soup. When it comes to one's health and danger, we're much more concerned about the health issue than a halachic issue. And that's why it's ironic to notice that some people who, I'm not judging anyone, but some people who are addicted to smoking, I'm not addicted, so it's not an issue for me, so I'm not judging anyone. But let's say people who are addicted to smoking feel they can't stop. So, however, assuming this person is a Shomer Shabbos, so all of a sudden he can't stop, but on Shabbos he doesn't smoke. So it comes out ironic. When it comes to Shabbos, so then he's willing to stop for. But when it comes to one's health, the fact that he's killing himself, that he doesn't, so it's really against, I'm not saying he should smoke on Shabbos, but Chamira Sakanta Meisuris, so we see you have to be more strict when it comes to your health than when you do when it comes to, let's say, a halakha concern. So we know life, and there's many examples, and even the Gemara even talks about putting coins, dirty coins in your mouth, even during the days now, and they have many different halachas, you'll be amazed, with Shmartim Elun Atroseichem, in terms of health issues, tremendous health issues. So life is definitely of tremendous value, and that's why, on the converse side, that's why suicide is a very severe prohibition. In last week's parasha, in Parashas Noach, the Torah quotes the verse, that the Talmud learns out, the prohibition of committing suicide. And that's why, in fact, the Shulchan Aruch, the Talmud, when they talk about suicide, it's in such severe terminology that a person who commits suicide, they lose their portion of the world to come, there's no shiva, you have to bury him in a different cemetery. Let me just point out that those type of people, usually we don't really have today. In other words, when the Gemara is talking about a suicide a case where you don't get buried in the Jewish cemetery, there's no shiva. That's talking in the theology, that basically, hypothetically or in reality, let's say you have a philosophy professor who objectively he has a great life. He makes $200,000 a year, he has his home, he's comfortable, but he develops a philosophy in life, how life is terrible and it's not worth living. So perhaps, something like that, which objectively there's no external factor, so perhaps maybe that's what the Torah is referring to. But someone who commits suicide out of depression, or anyone, let's say, living during the Holocaust, and they had to go through people, the Nazis coming in, they're going to kill them, their families, whether it's permitted or not to do, it's a separate question, but that wouldn't fall under the category of suicide. So we see that suicide is a very severe, it's because the philosophy behind it. I'm not saying the person himself is thinking that either, but the philosophy of suicide is you're running from the pan to the fire. If you believe there's a next world, so you're going to have to give an accounting. Well, we find similar, we find the commentators going crazy over cremation. The cremation is, there's a halakhic reason not to do it, but then, but from a philosophical point of view, it's much worse. So this from a pure halachic point of view, the reason why it's problematic is because the Torah says you have to be buried. So by definition, once you do cremation, that's not you anymore. Even if you took the ashes and put them in the ground, that's not kfura. In other words, by alpi halacha, once you go through a process of cremation, that's not, it's called panim chadoshos. It's called the new face. In other words, it's not you. So number one, just practically speaking, if you did cremation, you wouldn't fulfill your mitzvah of burial. But then, I guess they were dealing during the time of the Maskilim, during the time when it became very popular to do cremations. So I guess they were trying to trying to scare people out of it. So some poskim, right? And for anyone who does cremation, they lose the portion in the world to come. But why? What do they mean they lose the portion in the world to come? Is what they mean is like this. Again, it's only from a theology point of view that why is the why are you doing cremation? Because basically what the message was then, I don't know if it's true today. Today you might be doing it for different reasons. Maybe it's cheaper, maybe environmental friendly. I'm not talking about the person themselves. Why? From the concept of what cremation represents, is you're saying, this is it. It's finality. I'll throw my ashes in the ocean. I'll close up shop, and that's it. So it shows a denial of the next world. That's why they came down. It's not from a halakhic point of view. It's bad, but it's not. It's just you nullified. You didn't get buried properly. But many times it's the theology behind halakha. You find many times they use polemics in terms of, you know, trying to illustrate how bad it is, because it's not necessarily the act itself is so bad. It's what they represent. It's what the act represents many times. So that's by saying things. So by suicide, you know, most people, especially today, are not thinking in those terms per se. But so we don't. So practically speaking, it's very rare to have what the Torah considers a suicide. But the concept of suicide is a very severe concept, because just how life is so important, the taking away of life. And in fact, that's why, parenthetically, there was an article in the Hamilton Spectator on Saturday. It had an article on about Ramadan. It had an article, like I spoke in Cholom Village today, so I spoke about it. There's an article, basically, today is Ramadan basically is the seventh month, at least the way they count, the seventh month of the lunar calendar. And it's a month where they fast from dusk to dawn. And I don't think they... dawn to dusk, right? I don't think they drink either, I think the article said. They don't eat or drink. They could eat at night. And I guess it's a day of prayers. And they have once, and they go up to the... They go to the Mecca. They go up to Olarego, so to speak. We have three times a year we go up to the Beis HaMikdash. They go to their place. And so basically it's a whole article. But I was just mentioning one time, when was the first time I heard about Ramadan? I don't remember how, it was probably 10 years, I don't remember, it was a while ago, but I was watching, I play basketball as well as watch it, I'm a basketball fan, and I was watching basketball one time, it was during the playoffs, and they mentioned one of the players, I think it was Hakeem Olajuwon, who's a Muslim, they said he was fasting today, they mentioned something about Ramadan, so I was just thinking to myself, like, how come, like, I never heard about this before, why is the first time... How come last year they didn't mention him fasting, or the year before that? And then I was just thinking, it's because why? Because they go on the lunar calendar. So on the lunar calendar, there is no season. See, that's the difference between them. We know there's a lunar calendar and there's a solar calendar. So a solar calendar, we know, January, February, March, etc. A lunar calendar is that it goes by, it's 300, so practically speaking, 354 days in a year. 365. So you lose 11 days every year. So in Judaism, and it's going to happen this year, we have an Iber Shana. We add them every, it's about three times every 7 years that we add an extra month. So that's why Pesach will come out a little later, because we believe in the lunar calendar, or we follow the lunar calendar, but what I'll call a solar correction, that we also believe in the seasons, that the Torah says Sukkot must be in the harvest season, in the fall. Passover must be in the spring. So therefore, we have to keep honest to both the lunar and the solar. So let's say the Muslims only keep, or the Arabs only keep pure lunar. They only, and therefore, they're not, the sea, there are no seasons. Ramadan can happen any month of the year. And the secular world now follows the solar calendar. But the uniqueness of Judaism, we integrate both the lunar and the solar calendar. And it's not just a pragmatic thing, but there's a tremendous lesson to learn from that the Mefarshim, the Gemara talks about, there's something called the Sod HaIber, the secret of following the solar and lunar year together. What's it all about? See, today, we really don't pay much attention to what goes on up there too much, because we have watches, we have a calendar. But during the olden days, ancient wisdom, there's plenty you probably can learn from the stars, moon, astrology, all that. But they used to figure things out by looking and where things were. Today, you know, in that sense, we're pretty, at least talking for myself, pretty much in a literary, you know a little bit about that. But basically, you know, I look at my watch and the calendar, I don't pay too much. You know, when I go off at Kiddush Levana, once in a while, when it starts snowing, maybe I take a look up there. But basically, we don't look too much up in the sky. But really, there's a lot of meaning to it. Because Chazal tell us, our rabbis tell us, that the Jewish people are compared to the moon. That, what do you mean we're compared to the moon? So on a simple level, that what happens? The moon comes out at night. And there's a pasuk in Isaiah, a verse in Isaiah, which says, we're an or la'gayim, we're a light unto all the nations. So to speak, it's like the moon lights up the world at night. In the darkness, we're supposed to be role models. Tikkun olam, we're supposed to make the world a better place. However, and that's true, but on another level, they say that the Jewish people compared to the moon, because what's unique about the moon? The moon is very different than the sun. In fact, what is it called, the new month? Rosh Chodesh. And every month is called the Chodesh. Chodesh comes from the word Chadash, new, or the word Chiddush, creativity. It's basically the moon, like even when you go out for Kiddush Avada, people are looking all over, they don't know where it is. Depending on what time in the month it is, the moon could be there, that, it's waxing large, it's more, it's constantly moving around, and unless you know, you don't necessarily know where it's going to be. That's when the word Chadash, it's new, it's creative, it's flexibility. But the sun, that's something which is every day, comes sunrise, sunset. It's like Shana from the word Mishnah, which means to repeat. That basically it's the same thing at Mishnah Torah. It's supposed to be a repeated, a summary of the first four books. It's supposed, so day in, day out, the sun. So the moon represents flexibility, creativity, and the sun represents this stability. It's basically, that's it, day in, day out. So either one by itself isn't good. If a person does the same thing day in, day out, whether it's a trivial thing of eating the same thing for dinner, you get sick of it, or just doing in your life. A person always needs change in his life. So therefore, just doing the same thing day in, day out, it becomes stale. On the other hand, if every day you're doing something different, if you're constantly, you're living in one of these trailer trucks going all, I'm not judging those people, I'm saying, but person, you need a mix of both. So the moon represents the flexibility, the creativity. The sun represents day in, day out. So in Judaism, we integrate both. That it's not enough just to have you can't have creativity by itself, and you can't have this staple by itself. You have to have both. So our job is, that's what we do in Ibra Hashanah. We want to keep to the solar calendar as well. We want to keep to the seasons. So we go ahead and we combine both the moon and the sun. And in fact, that's really, I was explaining, that's a fundamental difference between Judaism and perhaps, all the other religions, Christianity, Islam, in terms of, this point, Ramadan is 30 days, you're fasting 30 days. And that, why it's the holiest day of the month, and therefore that's what people normally assume with religion, abstinence. How do you become holy? You live in a monastery, you don't eat for 30 days, you stay away from the physical places of the world. That's how it is in many other religions. But in Judaism, it's just the opposite. Shabbos, we think, is the holiest day of the year. It happens once a week, and we have festive meals, we drink, we eat, we sleep, we enjoy all the pleasures of this world. In fact, there was a Uri Zohar, I'm not sure you heard of him, he was a movie star in Israel, and then, movie director, movie star, and he became a Baal Tshuva. He became observant. And now what he does is he goes to jails, he goes to discos and tries to get people off drugs and try to bring them back, get their lives together. So he was a secular Israeli, and now he's an observant one. So he writes in one of his books, he says, when I was a secular Israeli, I wasn't a fan of any religions because I was secular, but the people that really got me sick were those Haredim, these Orthodox, these ultra-Orthodox Jews, these people in Meir Sharim, B'nai Brak, these people, Orthodox Jews. And I never could really understand, if I saw a priest, it really didn't bother me so much. I saw when I became frum, I started thinking about, what was it? What was it that I really got my stomach to turn? There's a famous story, they say over, the names change, because whether it happened or not, but again, the story illustrates the point, is the last time I heard it was Rabbi Twersky. So I used him. Rabbi Twersky is a professor. He has a PhD in Milwaukee, Pittsburgh. The whole family is a very prestigious family. They have wrote a lot of books, etc. They're well known. So he tells over a story. Who's going to be this point? Rabbi Twersky, he dresses like a chassid. In other words, he's black, Rabbi Itkin, black beard, black everything. And he happens to be prolific in English. He knows English better than we know it. So he was walking somewhere down the street, maybe in New York, wherever it was, and I guess it was must have been a secular Jew came over to him and said, in Yiddish he was talking, he starts saying, what's going on here? Like, get with the times, you're walking around with this old-fashioned stuff, you're desecrating our name, you're making it bad for us, come on, why don't you dress normal, giving the whole spiel. So Rabbi Tversky said in English, he said, excuse me, sir, I don't understand the language you're saying, but if you're referring to my garb that I'm wearing, you know why I dress differently? Because I'm a Quaker. I'm Amish, and we have a quaint tradition, and this is the way we dress. Oh, that's so nice. It's a tradition you dress that way. Then Rabbi Tversky went crazy on the guy. But the point being is, so what's the resource that's along the same? He says, when I see a Quaker, so okay, I know he's different. I might think he's a little crazy. He doesn't use electricity. But I respect it. I have this world I'm enjoying. I think he's not. So, okay, great. You're holy. You can do what you want. Or I see someone in a monastery, a priest. So it doesn't bother me. I'm enjoying this world. You're not. Okay, so maybe you're holier than I am. But an Orthodox Jew enjoys the same pleasures. He eats the steak and french fries. He has the nice cars. He has a nice home. He enjoys this world as much as I do. Well, what kills me, he thinks he's being holy when he's doing it. When he's eating, when he's drinking his wine and making the l'chaim, he's drinking his schnapps. When he's enjoying this world, he thinks he's going to get rewarded. He makes a blessing and makes the food holy. That's what really gets him, is because we enjoy the world. And that's what the job of a Jew is, to integrate the lunar and the solar calendar. We need the creativity as well as the staple. We have two parts. We have a body and a soul. There's an interesting story they say over, again, whether it's true or not doesn't make a difference, but to illustrate the point, they say over in Europe, European poverty, it's not like North American poverty, the husband was out 16 hours just to get bread on the table. And so, it's very hard living in different times. And, women, a Hasidic family, had about 8 kids, even during those times. So it's hard enough taking care of 8 kids if you have 8 nannies and you have a mansion. Imagine living in some little apartment and you have 8 kids running around, your husband's trying just to get bread on the table. Very difficult situation. And they say over a story where this one time the mother is she's losing patience, she's just like, can't take it anymore. Like, so, everyone has to, just reach a point where I just can't do it. So she goes into the kitchen. So during that time in Europe, I guess the equivalent of caviar or steaks is having a hard-boiled egg. That was considered a big luxury. That was a big treat. And it was very expensive. On Yom Tov, on Shabbos, maybe you had the egg. But, you definitely wouldn't serve it to a whole family with 8 kids. That'd be crazy. So what happened was, she goes into the kitchen. She locks the door. She goes into the refrigerator. She takes out the egg. She sits down on the floor and starts eating the egg. And then, about 10 seconds later, the kids start banging on the door. Mama, mama, I figure she's in the kitchen. What are you cooking, mama? What are you cooking? And she's sitting there, she's saying, I'm cooking up a mama. That's what I'm doing. If I take the 2-minute break here, I'll build up some energy, I'll have patience, I'll be able to become a mother again. That's the concept of the physical pleasures. Take them to be able to do your purpose. And in fact, what's the whole concept of l'chaim? Like we know, especially Simchas Torah, Purim, Shabbos, we're always making l'chaim. Where does it come from? What's the source to life? It's always to life, but why all of a sudden now? So we're actually, it's the end of the 6th parak in Shabbos. The Gemara talks about Rabbi Akiva at a wedding. He said, everyone, let's have a drink now. He said, l'chaim. So the Mumkacher Rebbe points out, why with wine? Like, what's the source with l'chaim over wine? So he says, one of the explanations, there are different opinions of what exactly the tree of knowledge was that Adam and Eve ate from, Adam and Chava, which they weren't allowed to eat from. In secular books, we always have a picture of an apple. But Judaism, that's not one of the options. One opinion is it's a grapes. So it's a grape tree. So what do you mean grapes? What do wine come from? Wine comes from grapes. So to speak, we say, l'chaim, we're not going to be like Adam and Chava. They took from the Eitz Hadas and they did it. They didn't listen to God. But I'm going to take this. I'm going to be like the mother. I'm going to cook up. I'm going to take this wine and I'm going to use it l'chaim to serve you, God. I know we're always looking for stringencies and to be machmir. So those of you looking to make a l'chaim over schnapps, I'll find you a source. Because another opinion in the Gemara is that it was from a wheat, that it was grain and wheat. And that's where a beer comes from. If you want to make a l'chaim over beer and schnapps, go right ahead. And that's the concept of the l'chaim. Interesting, a third opinion of what it was an estrog tree. And in fact, there's an interesting minig brought down with Jewish folklore minig that we eat, that especially a pregnant woman, but any woman, eat from the estrog tree right after Sukkot is over. What's the concept of a pregnant woman, especially, but anyone eating from an estrog tree? So it comes like this, because assuming that the estrog tree was the tree they ate, so according to many opinions, there was nothing special about this tree of knowledge except God said not to eat it. And in fact, they say if he would have waited 24 hours, it would have been permitted. But we know bitter waters are sweeter. It's, you know, it's like if someone tells you you can't have it, you know, that's when you want it. You know, why did the teenager cross the road? Because his parents told him not to. In other words, it's automatic that no one likes to be told what to do. So therefore, so what we do is we wait the whole Sukkot. We're using the lule of an etrog, and we're not allowed to get benefit from it because we're using it for the mitzvah. And all of a sudden, right after Sukkot is over, we take the etrog and we take a bite out of it, we cut it up and make jam or jelly, whatever we want, and we show God, I want to have an easy pregnancy because the Torah says, why do women have pain in the pregnancy? Because of the sin of Eve. So therefore we say, you know what, to God, if I was there, I wouldn't have been like Eve. Because look, I had the estrog in front of me, I waited the full time, and after the time was up, so to speak. But that's the concept of the l'chaim, is you take the physical things and you use them for good. And that's what the l'chaim of a wine schnapps, where you're cooking up a mama. And that's the whole concept of taking that we live in the physical world, and we can't deny our pleasures. Like everything, you don't go ahead building pleasures for the sake of showing off. But let's say a dishwasher. In other words, if something's going to make life easier and you can afford it, then of course you go ahead, you get the dishwasher, whatever it is. Anything to make life easier so you could do your thing, then it's definitely, you know, it's definitely something one should do. This is to go ahead and indulge in physical pleasures for the sake of pleasures, that's something else. Our job is to integrate both the sun and the moon. That other places, they just follow the solar, they follow the lunar. In Judaism, we incorporate both. That's the sod ha'ibra, the secret of the system, is we take both. We need stability. We need to have, you know, a job. You make your living day in, day out. But you also need more just to come back with the paycheck. You got to have some life to yourself. You have to have some creativity. And that's what the Jewish people on Nimshu are compared to the moon. That's every Rosh Chodesh, we get a renewal. We just had Rosh Chodesh this past Shabbos. Every Rosh Chodesh, we get a renewal, and we try to get a ruchnius recharge. So that's what I was pointing out, that the article with Ramadan. That we know one of the problems in the Muslim world is that there are many suicide bombers. There, go ahead and so whether Muslims are peaceful religion and these people are, you know, crazy people, because you have nuts in every religion, well, now, you know, that's what to be debated. The problem is that in, let's say, when you had the Baruch Goldstein case many years ago, when he went in and he killed the Arabs in the mosque, there was a tremendous outrage. Every Jewish leader came out and denounced it. And in other religions, someone does a crime, the problem is, in this case, the clerics are the ones who are worse than the ones. If you listen to the sermons Friday in synagogue, you know, when you get the tapes and you get played in English, you hear the hatred that's, you know, so I'll leave that an open-ended question. I don't know enough about Islam to know. But either way, the bottom line is the problem there. But one of the problems is, if you put too much focus on the next world, you end up negating this world. So if you don't find in Americans and Israel, you don't find, it's very hard to find suicide bombers. Because if you have someone who value life, they're not so quick. I'm not going to just go ahead and jump into, but if someone, if your whole function is just for next world and you negate this world, so I'll just head up to the 72 versions now. I waste my time here. So that's why in Judaism, even though Olam Haba is one of the, according to Maimonides, one of the major things we have to believe in, and if you don't believe in it, it's a serious problem, yet you won't find any mention explicitly in the actual written Torah. You won't find any, you know, the Gemara learns that from this, but we wouldn't know by looking at the Pasuk it's talking about Olam Haba, because the Torah was very concerned about this. They realized that if you put too much emphasis on the next world, that's what ends up happening. You end up negating this world. And in Judaism, this world's just as important. In fact, the way to determine whether you'll be getting a front row seat or you'll be sitting in the bleachers is going to be what you're doing now. That's this next, the next world might be the eternal life, but where you're going to be placed there depends on what type of life you live now. So it's very dangerous when you focus. That's, you know, any extremes in general are always dangerous. As the Rambam writes, all extremes are bad. The Rambam writes in the Shmona Prakam, and he gives an example. That he gives an example with a reed. He says, let's say you have a reed that's bent a little bit to the left. He says, so let's say you want the reed back in the middle. So he says, if you just put the reed back in the middle, eventually it's going to come back to the left again. What do you have to do? You have to go ahead and put the reed all the way to the right, and eventually it will come out. So he says, all extremes are bad, except, he says, if you have a sickness. In other words, it's like saying, you know what, this person was sick, so he took antibiotic and became better. So I'll say, you know what, well, this person was sick, and he took this medicine, he became better. I'll imagine if I take, I'm feeling great now. That doesn't work that way, because medicine, you have a deficiency in your body, the medicine comes to fill it up. So it only helps to take medication when you're sick. So too, once in a while, you have to go to an extreme. Just, if you have a sickness in an area, let's say the Rambam writes in certain midos, let's say sometimes you might have to go, if you're a miser, and you don't want to, then sometimes you have to go to the opposite extreme and give a lot to get back to the middle. But ultimately the goal is the golden way is the middle path. All extremes are bad. That's what Judaism is all about, balance, integrating the sun and the moon, the physical and the spiritual. And that's what the Torah realized. If you put too much emphasis on the next world, you end up with suicide bombers. That's why the Torah, we see, puts a tremendous value on life, and conversely, the tremendous punishment on one who commits suicide, the one who doesn't value life. And of course, as we said, from a theological, not the people today, not people who commit suicide under stress, but people who actually believe life isn't worth living, and everything's objectively fine, those are the people. And it's interesting that the Torah has the lesson, ach. Ach is always an exclusionary term. So the question, is there ever a time where you can commit suicide? Because it says, ach, is always, so the Medrash quotes on that pasuk, ach, to exclude Shaul HaMelech, to exclude the case of King Saul, that King Saul committed suicide. Well, it depends how you read. If you read the end of, so it's repeated twice, at the end of Samuel 1, it's brought down, and then it's repeated again in the beginning of Samuel 2. So if you look in Samuel 1, it looks like he stuck, you know, he committed suicide. He fell on top of his sword. If you look in the beginning of Samuel 2, it looks like this other person killed him. But either way, Shaul is known in the literature as committing suicide. So according to some, Shaul did the wrong thing. He wasn't allowed. But the consensus view is that Shaul was justified in committing suicide. The question is why? Why was Shaul justified? Like, what's the exception to the rule? So those are different explanations. One opinion is because a Navi told him. A prophet told him he was going to die, so he knew for sure he was going to die. So if he knew for sure he was going to die, so then he was permitted. Others say because he was the king of the Jewish people, it would have been a tremendous desecration of God's name if he would have been paraded around on the streets. Others say because he realized he would have been tortured and tremendous, in a tremendous pain and suffering, wouldn't be able to succumb to it. But the best answer I heard was, the reason why Shaul was justified is because it wasn't suicide. What do you mean it was? He killed himself. What do you mean it wasn't suicide? Because ultimately, Shaul, as we discussed a little bit last week, the values of life, Shaul saved thousands and thousands of Jews. Because what would have been the scenario? Let's say Shaul would have been taken captive alive. Besides the fact they would have paraded him on the news, this and that. But what would happen? You're going to have thousands of Jewish soldiers who are going to try to make an attempt to try, you know, if Sharon or someone else, or, you know, someone was captured, you're going to have many rescue attempts. And the Plishtim were mighty, mighty nation. Kind of like, you know, let's say the Jews in the wars, they got to try fighting against the Nazis. They're totally outnumbered. They don't have machinery. The Plishtim were far superior. So they realized, Shaul realized, if I don't kill myself, you know how many thousands and thousands of Jews would be killed? He was actually saving lives, not killing himself. In fact, interesting, based on this, we'll conclude on this, there's a contemporary question that came up. The Israeli government didn't actually ask the question, but someone asked this Rav, Rav Gershuni, who lives in Israel. There's a following scenario. This is when the soldiers were, I guess, hanging out in Lebanon during different times. And basically the head soldier said, make sure you don't go into the water, you don't go in this area, because a lot of times the Arabs hide out and they're going to get you. And whatever, a couple of soldiers didn't listen. They went in the water and they were kidnapped. They were taken hostage. So one question was, should we go in and rescue them since they brought it upon themselves? That's a separate discussion. But assume you still have an obligation to go in and rescue them. So the question they asked was like this. It's something called a poison pill that many have, I guess, in many armies. Basically what it means is, if you're concerned you're going to be tortured and you're not going to be able to withstand the torture, so instead of giving away state evidence and all this vile information about the country, so you want to just take the... So this, everyone, I guess, I don't know if everyone has it, but they have a pill with them for these situations. So the question was, we know what Judaism thinks about suicide, so they asked the Shiloh to this, are you permitted to take this pill? So he answered, yeah, we have precedent based on Shol HaMelech. If someone has information that's going to put the whole state of Israel, millions of Jews, in jeopardy, so then that's the ach, those are the couple of exceptions where, again, you know, we shouldn't have to make such decisions, but in those situations, you know, then there are some extreme situations where even suicide is justifiable. We don't have it today, but Pelegish, there's a different concept of Pelegish, which at different times were permitted. That wasn't adultery. In other words, biblically speaking, a man could have many wives, but obviously a woman can't, because practically speaking, you got to know who the father is. So biblically speaking, but obviously today, because obviously it's not going to work out, having many wives, you know, even though there are, I think, some Sephardim or in different, I think, Middle East, I think they just found someone who, like, they found he had, like, 50 wives somewhere all over the place. I heard it on the news, like, a month ago, I don't know, but that's not the adultery, that's technically, today you can't do it, but I'm saying, but Sephardim do have, because Rabbeinu Gershon came along and said you only could have one wife. So then, but that was only accepted among the Ashkenazi community. I don't think it's the norm among Sephardim, but there are. But I've heard, you know, I don't know anyone, but I've heard there could be some. Right, the beginning of a state. Right. But not your kids. No grandfather. Any questions? Dave?